powerful moment I'd had in my entire life. More powerful than the Homeward Bound sassy survival reveal. I didn't need forgiveness. I needed to realize I had nothing that needed forgiving. Difficult to appreciate when your head is full of dreadful thoughts and fears, but it paved the way for a new way of thinking. I soon began to feel comfortable with having OCD. Comfortable with knowing I had a condition that made me highly analytical, a total perfectionist, and overall, a good person. My therapist told me that the majority of OCD sufferers worry about thinking or doing the sorts of things they're least likely to do. For example, new mothers worry they'll purposefully harm their child. But actually, these mothers are the furthest from ever acting on such a thought or fear. The fear itself is so great, and is so far from the reality they'd wish for, that their mind is overwhelmed and plagued by fear and rumination. As I was beginning to understand my condition in greater detail, I decided to embark on a course of group therapy, just for lols, and there I met characters I'll never forget. It was like a sitcom about a coffee morning at an asylum, and I say that with respect. I shan't use anyone's real names, because most of them came from the Forest of Dean, and I wouldn't be able to spell them anyway, so let's fabricate a few. We had Nigel, who was obsessed with the sound of running taps after a particularly aggressive house flooding. Sarah, who couldn't touch any products from Morrison's, convinced that it would result in the loss of her children in a custody battle, and Samantha, who feared toys in the middle of the carpet. I respected all of them, but found them fascinating. If anything, the comedy gold I found in each of their individual stories made it easier to think that, to someone else, my concerns were equally as ridiculous. The links they were making were so nonsensical and non-existent that it made me realize how irrational my own fears were. That's a little harder to prove when it's your own moral code up for debate, rather than the supernatural curse of a Morrison's Battenberg, but still. I deemed group therapy a success. My therapist wanted to test Nigel's progress by leaving the tap on just enough that it dripped but didn't run. But this made Nigel sweat excessively, which in itself resulted in dripping, so it truly was a double blow for him. We never told Sarah the biscuits provided at our sessions came from Morrison's, because that probably would have been counterproductive. In hindsight, it would have made a fab YouTube prank. It was impossible at the time to imagine that I was going through such a horrible, debilitating experience for any other reason than it was the hand life had dealt me. But I like to believe that it happened for a reason, and even though it was the scariest, loneliest, and darkest time of my life, I'm actually grateful for it. Like being gay, OCD doesn't define me, but it certainly contributes to my personality. Luckily, I've managed to turn most of the traits that used to hinder me into positives that propel me closer to achieving my dreams. For example, you won't find anyone who can tell something is parallel by eye better than Rose CD, a nickname I was given at college. Being a perfectionist used to completely disable me. Creating nothing was better than creating something that wasn't perfect. Now I've managed to use that perfectionism and not let it stifle me, but let it inspire me to be the best that I can be. Doing my best regardless of the outcome is enough to feel satisfied with myself. I have extremely high standards when it comes to what I expect to achieve, but that has only benefited me as an adult. As the saying goes, shoot for the moon, even if you miss, you'll land amongst the stars. Unless it's actually the illusion of stars that have already burned out. That would be so unfortunate. One of the best things I was ever told was that I'd have this condition forever. Although the thought of that was terrifying, I was far too backed up to shit myself about it. So I made peace with having to adapt and move forward rather than sit still and resent my life. But moving forward, facing your fears and trying to make a success of yourself can be incredibly nerve-wracking stuff. This industry has really tested me. It's pushed me out of my comfort zone, which has resulted in tremendous rewards, pride, and satisfaction. But still, with each venture, there is a constant battle with anxiety. I now try to follow my fear rather than being restricted by it because it usually leads to the best places. I'd never have ended up at the Yard House in Miami to end our North American tour if I'd let my fear of flying stand in my way. And then I'd never have experienced cheese curds with a bourbon and honey dipping sauce, and what's life without that? Apart from one with a lower risk of heart disease. Sounds boring. As humans, we tend to avoid the things that induce the most fear. Our fight or flight mechanism can often malfunction when we wrongly determine that a situation will cause us harm. My fight-or-flight response is somewhat literal, in that my desire for flight usually kicks in during a flight. How can I get away from the thing that's getting me away? And there's nothing like traveling in a tin can germ pool with no exits to make you feel safe. For me, it's a nightmare. I'm completely devoid of control. I have to put all my trust in another human being. How incomprehensible is that? We're forced to interact with the people around us because we're breathing their stale, recycled air, which is slowly growing into a protein culture. And the only thing that can break up a deep vein thrombosis and developing spores is the turbulence that impairs my central nervous system. I've had some truly harrowing aeroplane experiences. I envy Rosie, who can quite happily relax to the point of falling asleep with her mouth open before takeoff. I don't know when I developed such a profound fear of flying, but then again, I don't know when I was first afraid of Alanis Morissette. The way I cope with travelling abroad is to obsess over the contents of my hand luggage. This, in addition to the clothes I wear, is the only thing I can control on a flight. I take great care to make sure my white trainers are truly white and that every item of my outfit is freshly washed. If I'm going to die, I want to smell good doing it, and it may even improve my chances. One of the hardest things I've had to harness is my relationship with superstition. OCD sufferers tend to make powerful links between our positive or negative experiences and events that have not contributed to their eventuality in the slightest. But we attribute these outcomes to events that have affected us so strongly that we tend to repeat behaviour to try to assure ourselves that we will be safe. It's like relying on a lucky charm for a good exam result, but on overdrive. For example, before our flight to Costa Rica, I noticed I had a splash of cooking oil on the t-shirt I planned to wear on the plane and spent the next hour assessing the situation so I could devise a plan. It wasn't as easy as choosing a different top to wear. I had to decide whether I wanted the unclean garment destroyed, hexed, or banished to a hell dimension. The frustrating part of my condition is knowing that my behaviour is irrational, but that I'm not brave enough to break the cycle. I'm told that intelligence has no bearing on being able to achieve this, and that my brain simply can't send and receive rational cognitive messaging as easily as the average human. I assume this is because I'm way above average. One of the most uncomfortable lessons I've learned in group therapy was about stamping out superstitious reasoning. On the whiteboard in front of us, Estelle, my softly spoken psychiatrist, wrote that her husband would die that day in a car crash. She asked those of us who believed it was going to happen to raise our hands. I paused. With a passion for private investigation, first I glanced at her ring finger to make sure that she was in fact married. There was a ring. But nothing confirmed whether or not she was married to a man, so it remained inconclusive as to whether she was lying about her flippant ability to risk the life of her loved one. My cynicism aside, the temptation to raise my hand was too great and up it flew. Estelle turned to me and asked me to explain how these two things were rationally linked. Well, I had a pretty solid answer. They're linked because my parents taught me never to underestimate the power of your words. Estelle paused momentarily. Sarah's insides were screaming, not because she cared about Estelle's husband, but because it wasn't clear whether the whiteboard came from Morrison's. Estelle said that it was very possible her husband would die that day, but if it were to happen, her having written it down would have no bearing on that unfortunate outcome. I giggled for a fraction of a second at her describing the death of her husband as unfortunate. Winsome, lose-some. But as much as I wanted to pick her theory apart, I knew she was probably right. It's the fear of the unknown that often makes something so powerful, so not knowing for certain whether there was any truth in superstition made it far harder to dispel it. My biggest achievement in this area was just before I took a flight to Chicago. I saw a penny on the floor as I was about to board, and in that fraction of a second my mind told me to pick it up or the plane would come down. I saw it as my greatest test. I bravely decided to leave it where it was and boarded the plane. The plane crashed. Not really, I was just making sure you were paying attention. I had a smooth flight and my irrational concern was quashed by my ability to see outside of it. It truly was a profound moment for me, but OCD has a wonderful way of flaring up beyond rational measure. And even though this was a huge step forward, I still suffer from the temptation of giving in to irrationality. This list is about the funny side of OCD. Everyone who suffers from OCD will experience it differently. Not everyone is obsessed with cleaning. However dark life might seem, sometimes you just gotta see the funny side. Like when Rosie developed alopecia and then realised she might never again have to spend money on dry shampoo. Here's a list of some of my quirky compulsions for lols. Kissing the door to avoid death by hellfire. Ensuring all of my stuffed animals can breathe before falling asleep. Making sure the taps are off by singing to them. Never playing music on an odd volume number. Making a small clicking noise with my tongue each time I set an alarm to make sure it's successfully set. Putting my phone on aeroplane mode while I bitch about my friends. just kidding, lol. Is this thing on? Understanding mental health orders is the first step to managing and eventually overcoming them. Looking back at my childhood behaviour, I'm not surprised it manifested so strongly as a teenager. My biggest recurring nightmare as a child involved the white glove, who was the smartly dressed severed hand of a magician. As an adult, I tried to analyse what this could have meant and came to a number of conclusions. Perhaps it was indicative of my artistic flair and was something I shouldn't ignore. Or perhaps it was foresight about always having cold hands due to bad circulation. Either way, I found it terrifying until the day I confronted it in my unconscious. I shook the hand rather than hiding from it, and it never bothered me again. It's possible that I started having the dream around the same time my parents banned me from watching The Addams Family, so perhaps it had something to do with that. I can't be sure. What I am sure of is that by avoiding something, we give it power. So with that being said, the best advice I can offer you is to face your fears and embrace whatever it is that makes you the most uncomfortable. You will reap the biggest rewards. The one spanner in my works is where spirituality fits into having a condition where being factual and scientific is encouraged to overcome it. If I'm supposed to ignore superstition, am I supposed to ignore my own spiritual beliefs simply because they're not physically tangible or proven? How does religion or religious thinking fit into rational reasoning? I believe in a higher power, an energy far bigger than us, that we aren't able to comprehend. Having faith is all about trusting something exists without substantial evidence. So needing to believe that superstition is groundless caused there to be conflict in my mind. It's about finding a balance, and in my experience, there's nothing harder. Growing up, I was adamantly against religion. I saw it as a power that was being manipulated in order to discriminate rather than to accept. It infuriates me to watch religion being manipulated and abused into control rather than allowing its true good essence to flourish. It's taken me years of trying to understand it all, and I'm almost at peace with the idea that I'll never know. But that's exactly one of the lessons having OCD teaches you, being comfortable with uncertainty. Being good has always been important to me. My mum actually blames Buffy the Vampire Slayer for negatively influencing me, and to a certain extent, I think she might be right. The show was anchored by a strong theme of good versus evil, and perhaps it affected my development in the sense that I was always looking for a black or white answer. Either way, as an adult, I have become far more spiritually awakened. I can't live a life thinking that this is all there is. It very well might be, and I'm not ungrateful for it, but I'm not naive or narcissistic enough to think that we humans understand everything about what we experience in its totality and why it's come to be. Or that we're alone in the universe. If space is infinite, there must be an infinite chance of extraterrestrial life, right? So the chances are we're going to find it. I can't help but think that people who say life is life and when you're dead, must fear the possibility that there's something we just can't grasp. This is problematic for the brain to accept, but it's my understanding that energy can be measured but cannot be stopped, only transferred into different energy. That leads me to believe in the possibility of life after death. I'm not saying that when we die we board the cloud tram which terminates at the pearly gates, but I can guarantee that everything in my idea of heaven would be parallel and freshly washed. Nah, heaven for me would be even more rudimental than that. A morning when Rosie didn't roll over and exhale her dog breath into my strills sounds idyllic. I believe in angels, and I believe that we all have a divine purpose that we need to recognise and do our best to fulfil. I think my purpose is to help other people who have faced similar struggles through communication and the arts. Or maybe that's wishy-washy orchestrated bullshit and life is in fact purposeless. But that's depressing, and if that was what I believed, this book would have been a lot shorter. Even the smallest acts of kindness can turn people's worlds around. Perhaps the meaning of life is to inject moments of happiness into someone else's day, so that together we can all make our years here on Earth more bearable. What a great responsibility, to have the power to heal people with kindness. In a time when it's so easy to publish your opinions online, when keyboard warriors can remain hidden behind their anonymity, if there's one thing I'll push throughout this book, it's to subscribe to our channel, but also to treat people kindly, unless they're dicks with dumbass opinions like, there's no such thing as global warming. For anyone suffering from OCD, anxiety or depression, please trust me when I say that however debilitating, exhausting or impossible it may seem, it doesn't mean you can't achieve every inch of your potential. It'll be a battle that will often seem too great to overcome, but with patience, learning, and subscribing to our channel, you'll realise that it's nothing but an impy little bitch. So make it work for you. And when you do, pay it minimum wage. Everybody has quirks. A person who claims to be totally sane is either lying or not very bright. So here's a list of crazy quirks to prove that we all have our issues. Rosie eats her nostril findings, yet judges me for not taking my cup downstairs after I've used it. I can't begin any task until the floor is immaculate. Neither of us can hang up the phone until we've said at least 7 consecutive byes to avoid the possibility of an abrupt, premature hang-up. Rosie chews food evenly on both sides of her mouth or feels upset. I believe that polishing something will make it work better and that anything with a scratch is rendered useless.
I have mental health problems. I'm not ashamed to say it, and I don't believe that many of us breeze through life without experiencing any mental health issues whatsoever. I used to be absolutely fine, and now I'm not. And that's okay. I can pinpoint almost exactly the period in my life when I became not fine. And that was during my 3rd year of university. University is when everything got a bit insane for me. The 1st year was a breeze. All I had to do was pass the year, and none of my grades mattered. I'd met my boyfriend just before I enrolled, and I spent a lot of time raving to my friends about how great he was. He moved into my pokey flat with no central heating, and we figured out pretty quickly that it was way too small for both of us. So, we moved into a more human-friendly apartment. Fast forward to my 2nd year, and things were vastly different. My boyfriend broke up with me and moved back in with his mum, leaving me in a bigger flat which I couldn't afford. I started dating Rose, and her academic drive both inspired and frightened me. Looking back, it's quite clear that I'd bitten off more than I could chew. My dream was to become a radio presenter. So as well as working at View Cinema and doing my university work, I also attempted to juggle a weekly radio broadcast and another job at a different radio station. I also started writing a regular column for a local magazine. I didn't realize it at the time, but I think I was competing with Rose a little bit, and I put a lot of pressure on myself to succeed. Throw in the struggles with my sexuality and having Rose as my first proper lesbian relationship, and it's not hard to see why I started freaking out. It was during the 2nd year of uni that I also went through something pretty traumatic, but I wasn't prepared to deal with this until much later, so I pushed it aside in my mind and threw myself into my work and studies. I was also making YouTube videos with Rose, and some of our viewers were tuning in to our little local radio show, which we broadcast live each week. I began to gain more followers on social media. Through our weekly show, I was offered an internship at a larger radio station, hosting events and running their social media accounts. I can remember starting to panic. The weight of my responsibilities was beginning to drown me. How was I going to keep up with my uni work as well as all these jobs? My peers were not impressed with me getting the internship. The competitive nature of my degree course led to a touch of resentment. I can remember coming into class and finding them all sitting in different seats to usual. It was disappointing to see that they were unable to be happy for me, since we were all working towards a career in media, but my foot was already firmly in the door. For the first time ever in my life, I started to care what people thought. Coming into class and hearing people whispering behind me stressed me out, and I became mildly paranoid. When I look back, it upsets me that I suddenly started to care. I used to be so unfazed by the opinions of others. But I'm also a firm believer in everything happening for a reason. Not caring about other people's opinions can make you a very blunt person. While I gained the feeling of paranoia, I also gained self-awareness, and it taught me a bit more about respecting the feelings of other people. So, in a way, that testing time made me a far more considerate person. So, despite my mounting responsibilities, I took on the internship in the role of event organizer. Because I had to turn up to oversee events, it meant I had to start learning to drive. In the meantime, I was relying on other people, usually Rose, who would have to reschedule her weekend work shifts to ensure I got to where I needed to be. Everyone wanted me to hurry up and pass my test, so I booked it in much sooner than I should have. While I was practicing the day before my test, a car crashed right into the driver's side and I just lost it. Naturally, after the shock of an incident like that, I failed my test and I developed alopecia a few weeks afterwards. This was a total curveball that life threw at me. One morning, I woke up ready to enjoy my day off. I was sat in my kitchen looking at my phone while Rose was making me breakfast, and boom. I still don't know how Rose had the guts to tell me that I had a bald patch right on the top of my head. I didn't believe her until I went and looked in the mirror. I immediately booked myself a doctor's appointment, and the doctor I saw will go down in history as one of the worst doctors of all time. He looked me dead in the eye and said, "You're going to lose all your hair and it will never grow back." Luckily, neither of those things turned out to be true, but I did continue to go to bed and then mysteriously lose hair during the night. What was mysterious about it was that I never knew where the hair actually went. Another thing the doctor told me was that alopecia was an autoimmune condition. I told him I felt very stressed and asked if my surprise hair loss could be something to do with that. He said there was no way the two could correlate. How very wrong he was. I signed up for therapy on the NHS, but in the meantime, my mum recommended I see her friend Sam, who was a trained therapist in Malvern, and I was lucky enough to see her for free. Thus began my first course of therapy. Let me just pause this story right here and interject with a personal opinion. Therapy is fucking awesome. Everybody should have therapy. In a way, sometimes we give each other therapy simply by listening to each other's problems. There is nothing embarrassing about having therapy or about needing therapy. Everybody in the world has issues, big or small. Also, my therapist had a therapy dog, and that made therapy 10 zillion times better. Everything is better with dogs. Everything. I told Sam that I could never sleep, and with a little further questioning, she helped me discover my fear of the dark. I thought she was being silly. She told me to go home, switch on all the lights, and try to sleep. I went home. I switched on all the lights. I slept like I was in a coma. We discussed my dad leaving, my sexuality, my family, my relationships, my work life, and my car crash. She told me that I was pushing myself way too hard, and that I had a fear of failure. I'd put a ridiculous amount of pressure on myself to get a first-class honours, and had made myself believe that there was no other option. With every therapy session, I was waking up having lost less and less hair. Finally, Sam suggested I try beta blockers, and when I started taking them daily, my hair actually started growing back. It was kind of a miracle, actually, because most people with alopecia are very lucky if their hair grows back the same. Sometimes it can grow back white, or curly, or not at all. The stupid doctor was wrong, and as I overcame my stress and fears, my hair loss stopped altogether. There was a direct correlation, and I learned an extremely valuable lesson. Your body will do crazy things to let you know that there is something wrong. I stopped my driving lessons and quit my job as event organizer for something closer by with much less mental pressure. I started working at New Look. Although I saw it as a step backwards in my career, I have to admit that it did wonders for my mental health. Working at New Look was easy. You saw clothes on the floor, you hung them up. I made a huge group of girlfriends, and my mental health really started to improve. That was the first time in my life I had mental health issues, and now is the second. So let's talk about my current issues. You guys always want me to tell you a secret, so here it is. I have a tic. A tic is a tiny word for what I consider to be a very annoying, embarrassing, and stressful problem. I first became aware of it when I started dating Rose. She would drive me around in her car and suddenly I would make a noise, or jump, or click, and it would shock her. I didn't really worry too much about it at first, but as time went on, it started to become more frequent. I started to notice that I would shout out words when I didn't mean to. I remember one time, Rose and I were on a train to see a musical, and I suddenly shouted a random word out loud. I was hugely embarrassed, and we were sitting opposite a group of boys who all stared at me. Although there wasn't really a way of recovering from that awkward moment, Rose immediately saw the funny side and we ended up laughing about it for ages. It soon started to happen more often and regularly in public. Sometimes it would strike when I was zoned out, not really thinking about anything, like if I was cleaning or showering or getting ready for bed. Sometimes it would happen when I was really busy and had lots on, and I would find myself saying sentences out loud without realizing I was saying them. I remember once being in an important meeting and suddenly feeling so anxious that I would shout out loud. As well as feeling like I was losing it by uncontrollably shouting, jumping and twitching all the time, I was noticing more and more similarities between my behaviour and Rose's, specifically her OCD compulsions. For instance, checking. Through YouTube, Rose and I are lucky enough to get to travel, and when we go away, we check the house like any normal person does. We check that the doors are locked, that the strainers aren't on, and that the hob is off. These are all normal steps to take to ensure that nothing can catch fire or that the house is safe from burglary. However, Rose suffers from checking OCD and could get caught in an exhausting loop of checking something, walking away, doubting herself, and returning to check again. She could sometimes be trapped in the cycle for a long time, and I began noticing that I was doing it too. Before we left the house, I would check that every single plug was off, that all the taps were off, that the heating was set correctly, and I would visit every single room to check that it was okay. Then I would do it again, and again. But unlike Rose, my checking goes further than this, and I would have to repeatedly check my handbag. If I was on a train, I would check to see if I had everything I needed, my glasses, my purse, my phone. I would check that they were there, zip up my bag, then feel a wave of anxiety flood over me, and I would unzip my bag and start the ritual again. I would do this for the duration of the train journey, then check again when I got to my destination. If I took anything out of my bag, I would check everything was there again, and sometimes I would make Rose tell me everything that was in my bag in case I didn't check it correctly. Worrying so much over one tiny handbag is nothing compared to packing an entire suitcase, and there have been times when it's made me cry. I am so afraid I will forget to pack something I need, and I write lists and make Rose go over everything I've packed just to triple check, but none of this helps. The worst part is when I hand the airline my luggage and go through security, because then I can't physically check my bag anymore. I know that many of these behavioural patterns can be picked up when living with a partner who suffers from OCD. But I had these ritualistic habits before Rose and I even met. I can remember being 14 and sitting at a train station checking my bag over and over again when a friend commented on it and asked what I was so afraid of. The idea of not having what I needed on my person made me physically tremble. I looked it up, and checking is actually one of the most common obsessive-compulsive behaviours. It's up there with obsessive cleaning. I was also noticing similarities in the way that Rose and I ruminate over things. Ruminating, in a nutshell, is thinking deeply about something. But too much thinking can be a bad thing, especially when you go over and over and over the same thought in your brain, overanalyzing it, prodding it, and allowing it to snowball. Sometimes when this is happening to me, Rose can see my eyes glaze over, and she grabs my hand and says,
"Rosie, you're spiraling,"
and pulls me back into the real world. I could ruminate or obsess over something for hours, days, or even weeks. I ruminate about different things, from wondering whether I said thank you to the cashier who just served me, to spiraling into a full-blown panic attack about something I said to someone years ago. Recently, the tick, the shouting out loud, the overanalyzing, the ruminating, the checking all became too much for me to handle. I was exhausted. When I was working, like editing or filming a video, I was okay, but the moment I was left with my own thoughts, I was troubled. I started feeling anxious all the time, over the smallest things, or even experiencing anxiety with no trigger at all. I just wanted to feel safe and comfortable, but for some reason, I never felt that way. I was also starting to feel quite depressed about it all. So, I decided it was time for another course of therapy. I looked up local therapists in my area and what they were qualified to deal with and found one who looked extremely promising, and not just because of her resemblance to Jean Holloway in Gypsy. I could have popped down to the GP and got referred, but fortunately, for the first time in my life, I had the money to pay for private care. The only reason I did this was because I felt that I needed to be seen right away before my mental health plummeted even further. Despite my high opinion of free available healthcare, it's a shame that the NHS can't always see people that quickly. Although it was awkward and embarrassing telling a stranger my problems, I was impressed with my new therapist's reaction. I was also impressed with the comedy-sized iPad Pro that she was taking notes on. That thing looked great, and I had professional equipment envy. From our first session, she told me that I had issues with safety. I asked her if she thought I had OCD, and she said, "Yes, but we have to work out why it is that you are doing these things." Then she blew my mind with a concept. She told me that she didn't think my tic was the usual tic when someone has an involuntary vocal or physical behaviour. She said she thought I was shouting out as part of suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and suggested I have eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR, therapy to cope. Although it felt overwhelming to spill out all my secrets to someone other than Rose, I hadn't even discussed any of my problems with my family. I felt hopeful that together we had made a plan and I really began to trust my therapist. Next on the agenda was to create a trauma timeline to figure out the things that might be upsetting me. How funny that though I was clearly very troubled and upset by things in my past, I didn't know what they were. My therapist had told me that even lots of tiny upsetting events can contribute to post-traumatic stress disorder. Life happened in a way that meant I wasn't able to see my therapist for a few weeks, so I had a great deal of time on my hands to think about this trauma timeline. But I didn't write it. I kept putting it off. Obviously, there was something I was just not ready to confront. In the end, Rose wrote down my trauma timeline for me, as I was finding it too difficult to face. She didn't presume to know more about my life than I did. She just said she would write down the things that she knew had been traumatic for me, and if I wanted to add or remove something, obviously that was up to me. We talked through the timeline she'd drawn up, and it was only then, years and years after the actual event, that I finally confronted something I had been through during my second year of university. I was raped. I won't go into any more detail because it's triggering and unpleasant to discuss. But what I will say is that I was only two or three sessions into my therapy and I was already getting to the root of my problems. I googled post-traumatic stress disorder and realized that I had every one of the symptoms listed. I also started researching other people's mental health reactions after sexual assaults and related so much to other people's stories. Therapy was helping me realize what my issues were, that I wasn't alone, and how to cope. I actually had my first session of EMDR therapy yesterday. It was tough, and not just because my hot therapist was wearing quite a short dress. I had to hold these little plastic thingies in my hands. I know, I'm excellent at descriptions, lol. And the plastic thingies would flash a little light one at a time, and I had to follow the light with my eyes. So I would be looking left, then right, then left, like watching a tennis match. I had to take myself back to a painful memory and tell my therapist my thought process while my eyes followed the flashes. I was really getting into it, despite the fact that I had snot dripping down my face, which I couldn't wipe away because I was still holding the plastic things. I had to imagine I was back in that traumatic moment and I could feel every bit of hurt and anger and disappointment like it was happening again. And then my therapist dropped her iPad stylus on the floor. I had to try to keep my eyes tracking the lights, but in my peripheral view, I could see that she was trying to reach the stylus with the heel of her shoe, which I found funny and mildly seductive. I tried to remain in the moment and keep going, until she actually bent down and crawled under her desk to retrieve the stylus in that dress. So overall, I'd say that my first EMDR therapy was a success, and that I'm looking forward to my next session, despite crying so intensely that I came home missing a nose stud. As I'm still currently undergoing therapy, I can't tell you how this chapter in my life will end, but it's already beginning to get a little better. In 2016, Kylie Jenner said that it was the year of realizing stuff, and that's how I feel right now. With therapy, I have realized a lot of stuff. Why I behave the way I do, why I think the way I think, and what all that might mean. I sometimes wish I could have realized it all back in 2K16 like Kylie did. But Rose reminded me that most people have some kind of crisis in their life at least once, and we can't all go through it at the same time because that would be carnage. Something I know I do wrong, which I'm trying to fix, is being too hard on myself. I've seen a lot of people I know do this too. Sometimes you are your own worst critic. I might berate myself for not working hard enough, not completing my tasks for the day, or not immediately clapping back with an excellent retort. On the one hand, it's amazing. I'm a pusher and I push myself to be the best I can be in all areas of my life. On the other hand, I give myself unrealistic expectations and then punish myself for not living up to these impossible standards. Another thing I'm totally shit at is giving myself any sort of praise. I do something right and I move on. I know I need to make more of an effort to celebrate even my smaller feats. But it's not all bad. Everyone has problems and mine are hardly the worst. I have definitely experienced anxiety and I am unlucky enough to have been on the receiving end of a few unforgettable panic attacks. I can remember, as if it was yesterday, the first panic attack I ever had, and it was about losing Rose. We had an argument and we couldn't reach an agreement, and I thought to myself, this is it, it's going to end, and I don't want it to end, but it has to end. And before I knew it, I was totally gone, lost in the void of what-ifs. More recently, I had a totally unfounded and irrational panic attack that I would lose the use of my legs. I made myself so ill that I took off all my clothes and sat there naked, just trying to get some air into my lungs. It was about 3 a.m. and I left sweat patches on the bed. Now I can look back at that and laugh. But just because something is stupid and irrational in hindsight, it doesn't mean you can't panic about it at the time. Coping mechanisms. I've definitely picked up a fair few tricks on how to cope with anxiety, panic attacks, and problems in general. It goes without saying that what works for me might not work for somebody else, but here are a few ways I have managed to heal myself. Meditation. A big reliever for me has been meditation, even if it's just for 3 minutes a day. I use the free version of the Headspace app. No, this isn't Spawn. You buying the book was amazing enough. And I go particularly crazy with this before I do a live event. It helps create a small gap in time between the persistent dashes to the toilet. Less caffeine. Despite my serious addiction to caffeine, I have found that when one is overburdened, lessening your caffeine intake does wonders, as does a huge glass of cold water or a wonderful chamomile tea. Journaling. One thing my first therapist taught me was to keep a diary, even if you just scribble random words in it. I used to journal every single night before bed without fail, and it's a foolproof method of getting things off your mind, and into Rose's. I dump my thoughts onto paper and leave them there, allowing space for beautiful dreams and a tranquil sleep. Routine. My therapist taught me the value of a good routine to get some wind-down time before bed to allow your mind to take a break for a bit. Unfortunately, I'm not too great at following my own advice, so my good routine has flown out the window. But it was great while it lasted, and I strongly recommend to anyone who has trouble sleeping that a hot bath and a good but semi-boring book before bed can work wonders. I understand that all of the tips I just went through are probably common knowledge and are stuff your grandma might have said to you. I also understand that when struggling with mental health issues, a nice bath, good sleep, and a good book are not the cure to all your problems. But what I will say is that sometimes people say things like, make sure you drink enough water, so often that you end up ignoring it. But try not to forget that sometimes the small, simple things can really help and that your grandma says them for a reason. I'm also learning a lot about self-care, and this is where the internet and, more importantly, you guys come in. I've been vocal about my anxiety, speaking about it in a few vlogs and also on Twitter. The amazing part of having an audience is the huge response you can get to any question or problem raised. You guys have linked me to calming websites, breathing exercises, relaxing games, you name it, you've recommended it. Rose and I are also part of many group chats on Twitter, and you guys are incredibly supportive and are always reminding Rose and me to rest, not to work too hard, and to drink plenty of water. I really appreciate people taking the time out to give me tips and helpful comments, so thank you. I can honestly say that you have truly helped. In fact, there's nothing wrong with asking for help. I have sometimes written on Twitter that I am feeling a bit down, and my friends have immediately texted me. I don't know why, but it always surprises me how kind and considerate people are. You might also be surprised when other people know exactly how you're feeling and have some helpful advice. One thing I'm beginning to learn is that you are truly not alone. Whatever problem you are suffering with, there is someone else out there suffering with the same issue. This thought has brought me comfort because no one wants to feel totally isolated and alone. Discussing my mental health problems with Rose has only deepened our bond. In fact, it has made me even more certain in my belief that Rose and I are meant to be together. Her ability to understand exactly how I'm feeling is so comforting, and some of the hurdles I'm facing, Rose has already been through herself. I've met people who have OCD, and they have told Rose and me that seeing our relationship is inspiring because they worry that having OCD will make them difficult to love or strenuous to live with. They see Rose and me living happily together, and that gives them hope. When Rose and I started dating, she told me she suffered from OCD, that she had been clinically diagnosed and had attended both group and one-to-one therapy. She told me a few of the things she used to do in childhood, and some I related to and others I didn't. Rose used to have the compulsion to kiss the door of her downstairs bathroom each time she passed the threshold. She was obsessed that something bad would happen and routinely kissed the door to cancel out the possibility of a negative outcome. In her mind, this was perfectly rational. I find her obsessions and compulsions fascinating, cute, and a part of her. Rose wouldn't be Rose without her OCD. But please do not think I am trivializing her problems when I call them cute. I've been with her during some of her worst OCD episodes, and I understand and have witnessed how physically and emotionally hard and heartbreaking it is for her. But together, we can also see the funny side. Rose has an obsession with clean floors and vacuums the same patch of floor about 50 times a day. We could be desperately late and about to miss a train, and Rose will be shouting, "Hurry, Rosie, let's go!" while simultaneously vacuuming the problem area that's already as clean as it possibly could be. She buys antibacterial wipes and gets on her hands and knees to give it the attention it deserves. I can see that it's tiring and that she'd rather be doing something else, but she has the compulsion to do it and it has to be done. She will have to tidy the house from top to bottom before she brings anything new into it. For instance, if we were to get a new laptop for work, the entire house must be perfect for her to allow this new item to enter our space. She will have to clean the house in its entirety before she starts a new game on the PlayStation, like The Sims. Rose's dream is to make it to a third generation of The Sims playing the same family. The reason she has never accomplished this is because she will feel the family is no longer perfect and has to start all over again. Rose's obsession with perfection is something I love and admire about her. I believe it's the reason we are so successful. Her drive is sexy. I love how she wakes up every morning, bursting with creativity and ideas, and wants to get stuck in. It gives her so much energy, although sometimes her need for perfection involves staying up editing until 3 a.m. because she doesn't want to go to bed with an unfinished project. I love her need for perfection. I love how she wants her surroundings to be perfect, her work to be perfect. But people can't be perfect. To the people who suffer, whether it's with OCD or another issue, and worry that this makes you unlovable, please stop worrying. I can assure you that I have never once thought, "I really wish Rose didn't have OCD," or, "Rose's OCD really makes me hate living with her." The people who love you accept you for exactly who you are. Rose and I strive to lift each other up when it comes to our issues, and I cannot sing Rose's praises enough when it comes to how supportive she is. She has the time to talk through any concern of mine, and she never has any judgment. She doesn't care whether it's a small, petty point or something deep and life-changing. She never makes me feel guilty if I'm sad or down, and she actively tells me off if I ever apologize. Everyone has the right to feel the way they feel. The only downside to living with Rose and her OCD is that we can accidentally feed each other's compulsions. For example, Rose likes to have the volume of the car radio on an even number. Her OCD tells her that something will go wrong and the car will crash otherwise. I used to help her challenge this compulsion and would deliberately set the volume to an odd number to prove that the numbers on the dial do not affect her driving ability. However, as time passed, I also started wanting the numbers on an even setting. We can both sink into bad habits if we let ourselves, and this is something we definitely need to nip in the bud. I would like to mention that Rose has had years of different kinds of therapy and still suffers from OCD. She's accepted that she will always suffer from it because it is a part of her. However, she can live with it now because she has the understanding and the coping mechanisms to do so. I am having therapy and am confronting a lot of pain and trauma from my past, which is still affecting my present. I don't expect to never feel pain when I think of these traumatic moments, but I want to learn to be able to sit with myself and feel okay. It's a goal I'm working towards. But when I reflect, I realize that these problems Rose and I suffer with haven't prevented us from living our lives. We met, We fell in love. We got married. We've just bought our first house. We're doing a job we love. We're writing a book. So, if you are going through something, I want you to know that there is so much hope, and there are so many wonderful things to come for you. There are times when I still feel sad. I have some days when I can't do anything because I feel so down. But on a dog walk the other day, Rose said to me,
"Think of the worst times in your life. Did you notice that no matter how bad you felt, the sun kept rising and the world kept turning?"
This made me feel so relieved. She was right, obviously. Every day is a new day. Every day can be an improvement on the last if you try. Even when I'm upset and suffering, I still have moments when I laugh or feel so happy or in love. I still have goals and aims and dreams. I urge you not to give up because it truly does get better.
Chapter 5. Friends and Frenemies. My friendship circle is more of a line. Friends are a huge part of life. They shape you, they support you, they lift you up. Mine have been pivotal in their positive contribution to my mental health, and even though I can count my close friends on one hand, I take that over a dozen who are only friends at face value. I'm not too keen on burning bridges when it comes to friendships. I think it's fair to say that Rosie burns bridges, collects the charred remains, and displays them as wall art. And even though I respect her approach, it's not usually the way I work. I'm a believer in fighting for a relationship, but that doesn't mean you have to accept friendships that aren't positive for you. As I reluctantly approach my 30th year as an earthling, I've realized my social circle is actually more of a line. A line that connects me to Rosie. I used to worry that my tight-knit friendship group was unraveling, and that the reason was my odor, or because of flaws in my personality. But I've come to realize it's both. I'm lying, but sometimes I think it would be easier to have a straightforward explanation as to why friends disappear. I would tell myself that the only reason my circle of friends was getting smaller was because we'd all drifted apart, were living in different parts of the world, and had careers that were wildly different from one another. And despite all those things being true, there was still something in the paranoid region of my temporal lobe that hinted at the possibility that the real reason was me. Growing up, I always had a socially awkward disposition. When I was 6, I was mentally traumatized at a National Trust location for touching the exhibit. The telling off I received for reaching beyond the red rope had a profound effect on my development. It prevented me from reaching out to people emotionally in fear there was a line I shouldn't cross. Even though that statement's dramatically untrue, it's also believable. One should never underestimate a child's ability to carry shame. But some things I did take away from that embarrassing public experience were a trigger for my social anxiety, a blunt gift shop pencil sharpener, and the knowledge that period manners are not child appropriate since you can't touch or lick anything. As a result of National Trust Gate, I'm extremely sensitive to anything other than effortless, smooth social interaction, so I will go out of my way to try to achieve it. I'll fill any silence to avoid a painful momentary pause, and will bring as much energy to a conversation as possible. No need to meet me halfway, I'm always prepared to go the full distance, and will even pack my own lunch. I'm very emotionally in tune with myself and with other people. I pick up on tone and tact, and I strive for nothing less than perfect conversational synergy. So what's changed recently? Maybe I've just started to give less fucks. Or maybe I'm too busy to feel I need to take full responsibility for every conversation I have. Either way, I've noticed that I'm starting to pull back a bit and not always be the one who makes the most effort or goes the extra mile. Friendships are a two-way street, not a one-way road, and it's important to build them properly to avoid potholes and pitfalls. Like romantic relationships, they take work, honesty, understanding, compromise, compassion, and patience. But all of that sounds really time-consuming and potentially a little gay, doesn't it? I'm not sure if I can be bothered either. It's not that I don't want friends. I just don't want to go to the ends of the earth for them and then realize they weren't worth it. The amount of time I've spent going the distance thinking my efforts would be matched is time I could have spent snacking or inventing renewable energy. I know you shouldn't buy someone a birthday present with the expectation of one in return, but let's be honest, what's more satisfying than giving? Receiving. That's what Christmas is all about, and it's the message I plan to impart to my children.
I like to think that I have a talent for making new friends, but unfortunately, my talent sometimes fails me when it comes to making the right ones. This simply reflects my lack of forward thinking, and I'm always getting myself into situations I struggle to get out of. I've had a multitude of friends over the years, and I've learned myriad lessons because of it. I've learned not to get too excited about someone too quickly and not to share my secrets with the first person I meet, but to save them, put them in a book and make a profit. In this chapter, I want to go through some examples of my overzealous self getting too caught up in someone, then instantly regretting it. Basically, I've made the mistakes, so you don't have to. First, there was Kathy. Kathy was the new girl at school. My form tutor asked who wanted to show her around, and I eagerly raised my hand. I walked over to meet her at reception, and there she was. How can I say this without being mean? Kathy was scary. First of all, she was German, which is absolutely fine, just not what I was expecting. Secondly, her unanticipated and unshakable interest in me later led me to believe that Kathy was in love with me. I was taken aback by Kathy, but being the type of person who doesn't dismiss possible relationships based on bad haircuts and a possible culture clash, I was still keen to start a friendship. We walked around school together, Kathy bounding alongside me, panting, "Oh yeah!" It was all well and good until the tour had ended and I realised I couldn't shake her off, not even to dash to the toilet. There was no break from Kathy. I found her in all my classes, sitting dutifully beside me. I was beginning to get used to her ginger curls in my peripheral vision. Kathy invited me round to her house and I discovered two things. One, that her mother was also too much, and two, that Kathy and I had nothing in common. Initially, listening to the German translation for every household object was fairly close to fun, but after a couple of hours, I was tired, bored, and increasingly concerned I'd never see my family again. In school, I tried to distance myself a little and managed to hide for a lesson or two until Kathy found me again with her big, watery eyes and asked me if we were still friends. "Of course!" I yelled. I was trapped forever. This leads me on to Donna Kebab. Her name was Donna, so naturally, people called her Donna Kebab. I've never had one myself, but I'm sure they're quite lovely. We struck up a friendship when a supply teacher unfairly picked on her for her makeup choices. I was livid that a temporary, nobody excuse of a teacher dared question Donna's choice of blue eyeshadow. The supply teacher was lecturing us on how makeup should enhance natural beauty, and I loudly remarked that a makeup detour wasn't the natural way to enhance the lesson. Donna appreciated this, and we started sitting together in lessons, and I realised she was incredibly funny. The warning bell started ringing on an after-school trip to Donna's house. On the bus, Donna got out her lighter and started to set fire to the seat in front of us. The driver stopped the bus and yelled at us for the impromptu arson. I didn't appreciate the humiliation. It wasn't pleasant. Then we got to Donna's house, which didn't have a door. Donna offhandedly explained that it had been kicked in by thugs. Then she told me to hide my school tie so we don't get beaten up on our trip to the park. I got a bitter taste in my mouth, and not just from the secondhand smoke from Donna's menthol cigarettes. The final straw was when we went to the shops and I detected Donna's breezy penchant for shoplifting. After that, I was out and my giggles in the classroom with Donna were no more. Like Kathy, this bad decision-making pattern followed me around for years. It became clear to me that my problem lay not only at the beginning of these ill-fated friendships, but also at the ending of them. I just didn't know how to. It's fair to say that some people are not right for us, and it's natural for relationships and friendships to end occasionally. People come into our lives for a reason or a season. But if it's true that you have to go through a few bad eggs to get to the good ones, it's no wonder I went vegan.
Kathy, if you're reading this, I'd very much appreciate an introduction to German via household items. Knowledge is power. It's funny how adulthood has taught me to be able to predict where a friendship is going. There have been a few people who have actively distanced themselves from me because it's preferable for them not to have to ask about the things Rosie and I are doing. You have to remember that Rosie and I are from very small towns, and in the grand scheme of YouTube, we're by no means superstars, but anyone who's actually moved out of the Shire borders is deemed spirited, if not valiant. If you defeat the river troll at Lower Lidbrook to pass beyond the perimeter of the forest, you'll be awarded two wives and a talisman for your bravery and onward journey. So please don't think I'm blowing my own boar tusk when I raise the possibility of friends being jealous. It's difficult when that happens, but it's balanced out by the few amazing friends who've changed my life forever. These friends came to me when I needed them the most, just as I was recovering from my OCD and was anxiously back in education. Can you call art college education? I'm unsure. Our days were spent playing travel chess, learning substandard parkour, and seeing how many art supplies we could steal undetected. Tom, Emma, and Bliv were the three people who brought me out of my shell, who had zero judgment of my mental health, my bad skin, or confused fashion sense. They allowed me to be myself even before I really knew who that was. Being surrounded by uplifting, happy, and supportive people gave me the foundation I needed to grow. I really owe everything to them. I'd never felt so safe and secure in my own skin, even if it was covered in acne. These were the types of friends who could immediately take the power out of any concern. They were able to make jokes about any worry I had until that worry became so insignificant it barely existed. These relationships taught me never to settle for anyone who doesn't accept you for everything that you are. Because even if you don't love yourself yet, others will. And they can help you discover parts of yourself you never even thought of celebrating. Friends like these come once in a lifetime. I don't see them often, but when I do, I'm 18 again. Whether we're joking about dropping Tom's kids, leaving tips in a foreign currency, or reminiscing about the old days, I'm proud of their successes and I know they're proud of mine. And that's what true friendship's about. Not resenting people for the things they have or the places they've been, but being happy for them. Tom and his wife Lauren have three beautiful children. Am I jealous of their family? No. Did I offer to buy one of his kids? Yes. But as a friend, I accepted his refusal to sell his baby on moral grounds. That's called understanding. I think it's good to rise above things and not let pettiness get the better of you. However, everyone has that one thing they can't let go of. I'm still angry that Tara was killed off so brutally in Buffy season 6, although I've tried to make peace with the fact that her death was the narrative catalyst for Willow's dark arts demise. In general, I try not to bear grudges, but I'm sure we all have one person from school we'd love to get one over on. That can actually be the best motivation to achieve your goals, like in the aftermath of a bad breakup, as you strive to achieve more in the race to Smugface. I am guilty of this. I'm human. I'm guilty of a lot of things, like flawlessness. A few years ago, we were in a very tricky position. We were given the opportunity to fly to Singapore to interview Tom Hanks, Ron Howard, Melissa McCarthy, and Paul Feig. So when this opportunity fell into our laps, we were totally over the moon. The drama arose when it clashed with a friend's wedding in England, leaving us in the position of having to explain why we'd be unable to attend the wedding. Perhaps you're thinking that good friends would have sacrificed the trip, and if that had been you, you'd have put your friend first. I get that. But we didn't grow up together, we'd never worked together, and we'd never shared X Factor-style sob stories. So it wasn't like I was letting down an inseparable childhood tie, and I felt no moral obligation to attend other than the fact we'd already agreed to. This wasn't a last-minute cancellation in the slightest. Rosie and I gave her 4 months' notice. I expected her to be disappointed, and I didn't feel great about prioritizing an opportunity over her big day. But what I did not expect was an itemized bill of expenses our cancellation would incur. When I got married, even some of my cousins didn't attend at the last minute. I didn't send them a bill. I sent river trolls, because it's the only way I know how to communicate. It was a little awkward asking if she wanted compensation for our cancellation 122 days prior to the event, but she assured me that she was simply highlighting the consequences of our cancellation rather than explicitly asking to be reimbursed for her losses. I thought about sending her the cost of a wedding gift I was yet to buy to highlight the potential expense our cancellation would incur, but was told this was unnecessarily argumentative. Even so, I was unsure as to why our places would cost her anything at this stage, or why they couldn't be just filled by other guests. But these are questions I was just going to have to live with, like never knowing why humans don't just sniff other humans the way dogs do, so we can quickly make an assessment whether or not to pursue a relationship based on butt smell. Something I really value in my good friends is their ability to interact. Sounds simple, but it's funny how many people don't adhere to the basic rules of engagement. A few months ago, Rosie and I met up with a friend for a long-awaited catch-up. This friend also happened to be a YouTuber, so it was great to have the opportunity to talk about things they'd understand as another creator. We spent a laborious afternoon listening. About 20 minutes in, I was resigned to the fact that I wasn't going to be asked a single question. No, but how are you guys? Or, haven't you got a UK tour coming up? Or even, do you want to hear more about my everyday breakfast routine? I didn't, but the opportunity to answer something would have been nice. How do people socialize this way without thinking the conversation is completely one-sided? I don't understand it, especially since I'm so careful not to dominate a conversation and will always ask about the other person first. Perhaps
Perhaps this is a good opportunity to list some of the qualities I'm looking for in a friend, followed by everything a friend can expect from me. What I expect from a friend. Willing to sing the chorus on days where I decide life's a musical. Would raise my children if I got bored. Would sacrifice an organ, even if I didn't.